Counsel in the third case may come forward and get ready. The third case on today's oral argument calendar is John Strosahl versus Doreen Strosahl, A18-1229. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please state your name at the beginning of your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michaela Wattenberger, and I am here on behalf of the appellant, Doreen Strosahl.
I'll let you know, just in case you're unaware, the lectern is adjustable up and down if you wish. There's a button right in the front, on the front ledge, and you can find your perfect position if you wish. Yep.
Thank you. While a district court typically has broad discretion, particularly in cases where custody and parenting time decisions are involved, judges are bound to make findings that have support in the record and to correctly apply the law. The case at hand is not one where appellant merely disagrees with the decisions that the district court has made. Rather, in this case, the district court has made a series of material errors, errors which permeate the case and have produced an unjust result, which ultimately is most harmful to the party's children or child. The child, who has been primarily cared for by her mother for her entire life, and who, according to the custody evaluator in this case, is likely emotionally closer to her mother than to her father, has essentially had her mother removed from her life for the majority of each year.
Are you here before us contesting then the specific findings of fact?
Here, contesting findings of fact and errors in law made by the district court.
All
that's
right.
Correct.
And you will agree that as to the findings of fact, that the standard is whether they're clearly erroneous.
Correct.
And what specific findings can you refer us to that you believe are clearly erroneous?
As one example of a finding that appellant would submit is clearly erroneous, the district court made a finding that appellant testified that if she was permitted to move with the child to Germany, respondent could live with them when he came to visit the child. The district court used this, in fact, as an example of why appellant's claims of abuse were questionable. The problem is that this simply is not part of the record with respect to appellant's testimony. While it's true that appellant did testify, as noted in respondent's reply brief, that she had previously noted in her proposal to the custody evaluator that her proposed residence included a studio space with its own bedroom and bathroom where respondent could potentially stay when he came to visit the child. At trial, she specifically stated that though she still hoped to get a house with a guest space, she had lost the opportunity for the house that she was specifically proposing to the custody evaluator, that she no longer believed it would be a safe decision for respondent to stay with them. So the court's finding that appellant testified that respondent could stay with them when she came to visit, or when he came to visit the child in Germany, is simply not supported by the record. It's clearly erroneous.
Assuming that we agreed with that proposition, is this a very meaningful finding in terms of the court's conclusion?
I believe that it is, Your Honor.
In what way?
The court specifically referenced this finding in its domestic abuse analysis and as an example of why appellant's claims were questionable. The fact that she would suggest that the man that she was claiming abused her could stay with them in Germany was a basis for the court to find that her claims were questionable. So it is meaningful in that the court specifically used that.
It wasn't the only basis for the court's finding that there was no abuse, however.
The court's finding that there was no abuse seemed to be based on a couple of different things, you're correct. Seemed to be based on a lack of additional neutral supporting evidence, seemed to be based on the custody evaluators' findings, which are problematic in and of themselves, as I hope to address shortly, as well as this credibility determination, and this seemed to be a key part of that credibility determination. That
can I ask you this though? Because I mean, the judge heard that she made some statements that he could stay with her.
Correct.
And then at trial, she said, "Well, no, he can't," according to you. Well, I mean, isn't a basic tenet of our role as appellate court to give deference to the judge's credibility determinations, and the judge has the option of picking which version or which statements he wishes to believe. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I would say that that's correct in a general sense. I would say in this specific case, however, she was very clear at trial that that was not something that she was proposing due to the safety concern. And I would also note that in the record, if you look at the custody evaluator's underlying file, which was placed in the record, the proposal wasn't for him to share a guest room that was off of the kitchen where he could share their living space. It was for a studio with its own bathroom on a separate floor of the residence where he could potentially stay. So I think it was problematic on a couple different levels, both in terms of within the custody evaluator's recommendations, that statement wasn't correctly represented in her report, and then two, in terms of the fact that it differed, of how it differed from her testimony at trial, I would say that that's significant as well.
Are there any other facts that you can point to that specifically? And I think maybe because our deference is part of our standards here, if you could also get to the legal errors that you believe
of course
the district court made.
So as another finding of fact that to some extent overlaps, I would say, with the legal analysis, the district court also made a finding that the custody evaluator, who proved herself to be to at least have her neutrality questioned, as the district court itself acknowledged to some extent, ultimately found that the child would benefit from being with her mom and recommended sole physical custody to appellant and reduced parenting time for respondent. The district court also found, however, that these findings and recommendations of the custody evaluator were irrelevant because appellant was moving to Germany. Appellant would submit that this is also clearly erroneous. Pursuant to La Chapelle v. Mitten, a court of appeals case in 1984, in an initial custody proceeding, a proposed change of residence by one party is one factor to balance in determining custody of a child. Ms. Karen Cross testified in her report set forth that her recommendations, including her recommendation regarding physical custody and parenting time, were based upon the totality of the best interest factors after 7 months of gathering documents and interviewing the parties. And accordingly, the district court erred by finding that her recommendations regarding physical custody and parenting time were irrelevant because of one factor, namely appellant's residence. With respect to...
Did that case involve a residence in two different counties, two different countries?
I believe it was a residence in New York and a residence in Minnesota, if I correctly recall. So not two different countries. With respect to the errors in law that appellant is submitting occurred, as one example, the appellant would submit that the district court applied an incorrect legal standard with respect to domestic abuse. The custody evaluator, whose findings the court heavily relied on in this regard, found that without neutral supporting information, it was impossible to find conclusively that domestic abuse was a factor of significance. However, conclusiveness is not the standard of review, the proper standard for determining whether domestic abuse occurred. The correct standard is whether appellant has demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence that domestic abuse, as defined by Minnesota Statute 518B.01, occurred. And in order to demonstrate something by a preponderance of the evidence, it must be shown to be more probable that a fact exists than that the contrary fact exists.
But didn't the judge say that he couldn't make a decision on it? I mean, that there... he could not find by a preponderance of the evidence that there was domestic abuse?
What the court seemed to do was to weigh the custody evaluator's findings on one hand, in addition to the lack of additional neutral supporting evidence, which was also found by the custody evaluator, against what appellant would submit was significant evidence of domestic abuse that exists in the record.
Aren't you asking this court to reweigh that evidence and determine there was a preponderance of the evidence?
I think first we would submit that the court did not actually use the preponderance of the evidence standard, given the weight that the court provided to the custody evaluator's analysis and the standard that the custody evaluator applied. In addition to that, there are other concerns with the gathering of the evidence by the custody evaluator with respect to the domestic abuse and the way that the court applied the standard that it did apply. So I think there are...
What standard do you think the court applied if it wasn't preponderance of the evidence? I mean, basically, the court said there's insufficient evidence for me to make a determination.
Appellant would submit that the standard the court actually applied was this standard of conclusiveness that the custody evaluator seemed to apply, based on the significant weight that the court gave to that and the way that the rest of the court's analysis mirrored the analysis that the custody evaluator conducted. In addition to the burden of proof issue. And I would note, too, that there's this, under Minnesota law, the Domestic Abuse Act, 518B, is a remedial statute which is to be construed liberally in favor of an injured party. And I think that's significant here as well, that in applying the preponderance of the evidence standard, in weighing the facts, there should be this consideration that the Domestic Abuse Act is a remedial statute to be construed liberally in favor of an injured party, and that did not occur here. Separately but relatedly, there were significant errors in the gathering and analysis of the evidence relative to domestic abuse. For example, Ms. Karen Cross, the custody evaluator's analysis of the domestic abuse issue, which again the court relied on, was flawed, as both appellant's expert, Dr. Simon, and respondent's expert, Dr. Harrington, both testified at trial. Ms. Karen Cross does not seem to have adequately investigated the allegations of domestic abuse. She does not appear to have administered any domestic abuse screening. She did not request or review medical records from the parties. She did not specifically recall at trial asking the therapists about the specific incidents of domestic abuse. And she did not even ask appellant about each of her allegations of domestic abuse. In addition, the district court noted in its domestic abuse analysis that both parties contributed to the conflict, and that seemed to factor heavily in how the court analyzed this issue. However, the district court did not actually make any findings about the ways in which respondent contributed to the conflict. Rather, the court simply found that appellant did contribute to the conflict during the marriage because she recorded respondent, despite the fact that these recordings that occurred around the time of the party's separation near the end of the marriage, and despite the fact that appellant testified that the recordings were made in order to protect herself. Notably, the recordings were not a factor in any of the prior alleged abuse incidents, and in addition, only one specific recording was described at trial, which certainly does not demonstrate a pattern of conduct on the part of appellant. Appellant would submit that it demonstrates a profound contradiction and double standard on the part of the district court to say that appellant did not meet her burden of proof on the prior alleged abuse claims and then to fault her on the more current claims as contributing to the marital conflict because she recorded respondent. Importantly, there's case law suggesting that even if appellant did contribute to the conflict, mutual acts of domestic abuse do not support a finding of no abuse for purposes of a custody determination. Appellant would submit that this, the domestic abuse issue, is an important issue.
Did the court make a finding that there was no abuse here, or simply that the evidence was not sufficient to find abuse?
The district court made a finding that it did not find there was sufficient evidence to find abuse. That's correct.
It's different than finding that there was no abuse, isn't it?
I think, though, that it has the same effect in terms of whether or not these different custody presumptions apply. So for the purposes of a custody determination, a finding that there's not sufficient evidence to find abuse has the same effect as a finding that there was no abuse. So I think that it has the same effect. So, again, this is an important issue at an important time. Appellant would ask that the court step in to provide more guidance to the district courts with respect to the standards that abuse victims are being held to in the context of custody proceedings. I see that my time is about up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wattengruber. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am John Jerebeck. I am here representing the respondent, John Richard Strosel. This case is, and sometimes I get lost, and I look at my own brief and sometimes get lost in certain details of the case. This case is about a child. It's about a child who is five and is now about 7 years old, who has resided in Minnesota her entire life. The case is about, and the trial court judge did a great job of this. He asked mother to clarify at trial, and he said, am I looking at three options or am I looking at two options? And mother says, I'm moving to Germany with or without the child. That's important. That set the tone for the way this case was structured and how things went. When we look at 518.17 and the modified statute, she cites LaChapelle versus Mitten. That was actually a different type of case, third-party custody, I believe, before same-sex marriage. It was a different case with a different statute. When they modified 518.17, they put in tons of other terms, and you read through the terms, and most of them look at that issue of stability. And stability is very important.
Well, can I just ask you this? Because I hope the appellant will correct me if I'm misstating her case, but she's basically saying that, if I understand it, that the custody evaluator said if mom stayed in Minnesota, she would be getting physical custody. But because she's moving to Germany, that factor is such a big factor here that the judge made the decision based on just the sole fact that she's moving to Germany, that the judge gave physical custody to the father.
And I understand that is the argument, but what the judge said was, I'm not dealing in hypotheticals. He told everybody that. I can't deal with hypothetical situations. So the reason the 518.17 modifications are so important is because they look at that stability. And he goes through each one of those factors and weighs them now. Now, you look at Rutten v. Olson, some of those cases, the court is entitled to completely disregard a custody evaluation if they choose to do so. He took certain pieces. Not all the pieces benefited my client. Many of the pieces, and you look at the motion for amended findings and determination, he made that same decision. Now, there's a little bit of a disagreement because mother cared for the child for the first couple years, and then father came back, and then they were separated, And then once they were separated, there was a much more even schedule between the parents. So there's a little bit of a disagreement. But when he came to weigh that, he said, this one weighs in favor of mom. But we can't look at, and the judge was right saying, I'm a trial court judge, I can't look at this hypothetical. I can't do, if you do a custody evaluation, which was, I believe, done 8 months prior, and the judge at the time of trial is clarifying, because the judge doesn't have the opportunity to, people can present their case how they choose to present it. And she presents a case, and which I personally thought interesting, she presented a case actually for a parenting plan where the request made in her answer to both the legal separation and the answer to the dissolution. If you look at a parenting plan under 518.1705, one of the key pieces of a parenting plan is a requirement that you have a method for alternative dispute resolution. One of the issues with a method for alternative dispute resolution is the court can't grant it if there's domestic abuse. This was the request by mom. She's saying, I want this. Now, later on at trial, she changes her mind. And that is one of the issues. Later on at trial, she changes her mind. With regard to father living with them, residing with them if he's in Germany, she changes her mind. Now, I have a difference of opinion with counsel here about, because if you look at the facts, look at the actual testimony of mom, it's not quite what counsel says it is. What she said first was, I did indicate he could live with, father could live with us in Germany, number one. Number two, it was my position with the custody evaluator that he could live with us in Germany, which may go to your question about, does this really have major impact? Number three, she says, I'm looking for a place, and I'm still looking for a place with an extra bedroom at trial. And so for a judge to, and I don't think it's a big leap to say, her testimony is she's still agreeing that he can reside there. That is the factual scenario. When you look at it, and her statement with regard to, she testifies he can still look, she would still look at a home with another room, yes. Transcript 473. She makes that specific statement. So with regard to that issue, and I do believe counsel is correct and the court is correct here, it is, the domestic abuse issue is the big piece, because the allegation of domestic abuse would switch the standard. And that is why it was pushed. Now, it's interesting for me that if you look at the testimony, it seemed to mold into that as the trial went along. And at the end, attorney for mother is questioning and says, isn't one of the reasons not to allow a child or to allow a child to move because domestic abuse has occurred? And it's one of the few exceptions that are out there. And this gets molded into a case where it's our position, the only way they can stop the child from being, or allow the child to move, is if there's an establishment of domestic abuse. But the court did more with regard to domestic abuse in the findings than was indicated. The court says, and Your Honor here is correct, the court determined there was insufficient credible evidence to support a determination that a domestic abuse occurred. So the court looked not only insufficient evidence, insufficient credible evidence. And then we get back to who has a burden of production and who has a burden of persuasion. Mother has the burden of production. Mother has burden of persuasion with regard to those things.
And well, then what about the argument of mother that the Domestic Abuse Act is a remedial act?
Well, the argument with regard to mother that Domestic Abuse Act, and again, you, even in the Domestic Abuse Act, you still have to make the findings by a preponderance of the evidence. There has to be some showing. And by the way, the statement that the court made that there was some conflict between the parties, that happens in every divorce case that I bring. There's conflict between the parties. That's many times why there is a dissolution. Now, there was the conflict he points out with mom videotaping. He does make other statements with regard to there's insufficient credible evidence, and the judge makes a finding, you know, finding number 140 was the insufficient credible evidence, but he also says no OFP was ever brought by either party. No OFP was brought on behalf of the child. No police reports were ever brought. No allegations in the medical records in 2012, so it's not till 2014 that an allegation gets brought. And he looks at that and said, that's the first statement in 2014. Now, he is agreeing with the custody evaluator's determination because the custody evaluator looked at that and took information from mother's therapist, who was previously their marriage therapist, and the custody evaluator did an investigation. And in the investigation, she goes to the one therapist and she says, yes, mother has made these claims. She indicates there were no claims with regard to this during when they were in marriage therapy, and both marriage therapists say that. But there were no claims with regard to this, but she says now she switched over to the role as counselor to mom. I don't know if that's a great shift, but she switched over the role as counselor to mom. And as counselor to mom, she says, mom brought some things up, and then she says, no, I heard them from the second marriage counselor. And so the custody evaluator, doing their job and doing their job well, goes to that second marriage counselor and says, was there this issue? And the second marriage counselor then clarifies things and says, no, this was not an issue between mom and dad. This was an issue pertaining to a prior relationship. This actually was brought up with me, and it was about a prior relationship. And so, again, you have some information. That information is looked at by the custody evaluator. Father testifies as well, and father testifies there were no domestic abuse issues between the two of us. There was conflict, but not domestic abuse issues. And there's nothing in the record that establishes that domestic abuse occurred, except mom testifies. So mom testifies, and the court, after that testimony, says, I'm concerned with regard to testimony. And that's why I think that word credibility is in there, is because she said to the custody evaluator, she's saying to others, yeah, he can stay with me. The court didn't find that believable. The court did not find you're going to invite somebody who allegedly has committed domestic abuse against you into your home to stay there. And so the court says this information is not credible. With regard to, there was also some talk about the custody evaluator and and I believe it's brought up in the brief, the recommendation, the custody evaluator, whether or not the custody evaluator recommended that this child not relocate. And there are clear findings that this child should not relocate. And I think the point of that one was whether the custody evaluator was talking overall or talking about this particular child in this particular case. Either way, based upon the testimony, the trial court had the right to make the determination. The judge here, in this case, we have, I want to get this, make sure I'm correct with this. We have 11 days of testimony. We have 185 findings of fact. Some of those findings of fact have subparts. We have a 59-page amended judgment and decree. We have detail about credibility of witnesses. We have detail about credibility of mom's expert, saying, by the way, mom's expert came in, testified, came in from California, applied the wrong law. He applied the removal law. That's not the correct law here. So he disregards that. There are pieces of the custody evaluator's report that the judge disregards. The judge has absolute authority to do that, and the judge should do that. As a trial court judge, that's what you do. You weigh the information. You're weighing the testimony of the individuals. And now the burden here is to show clear error. In the Crosby case, it talks about this, and when I go through and go through, there are many requests, and I can't address them all, about what findings of fact have errors. And there, I believe there were approximately 20 different things saying, hey, nope, judge made an error here, judge made an error here. The judge has the broadest possible discretion in making determinations with regard to credibility. The errors look more like the ones alleged in the Crosby case, which are, judge, you should have believed me. You should have believed me with regard to domestic abuse, but you didn't. Therefore, it's an error. That's not an error. It's not an error that he did not find her credible. He didn't find her credible. It's not an error that he didn't find it credible that she said, you know, at first, he can move in with me. At trial, he says, I'm still getting that extra room, and then says, nah, I don't know if I necessarily feel safe with that. Was that an error of the judge? It's our position that that was not an error, that that is what the judge is supposed to do. Judge looked at credibility, weighed the credibility with regard to all these individuals, had many individuals testified, accepted a motion for amended findings, and then amended the findings to fit and make sure it met the evidence that was presented, and made a determination in the best interest of the child. It's our position that this case should be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jerebeck. Ms. Wattenberger, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I would like to speak to opposing counsel mentioned that La Chapelle v. Mitten was a different type of case. So I just wanted to point out that there are other cases that are specifically relevant to dissolution action and a relocation within a dissolution action. As an example, Stengel v. Stengel, which is also in 1984, the court specifically found in that case that the court should have treated the proposed move as simply another factor to balance in determining who should have custody under Minnesota Statute 518.17. Now, it was a prior iteration of that statute, but the fact is the court in that case still found that the district court should have taken the relocation as one factor to consider among the best interest factors. Next, I'd like to respond to a point made that the custody evaluator, that the report of the custody evaluator was not thrown out entirely, that the court did take pieces from it, and some of those pieces were not necessarily helpful to respondent, I think, is the claim being made. I want to note, I think that this is actually quite an important fact. The custody of the district court found that that there was reason to question the custody evaluator's neutrality, specifically in favor of respondent in this case due to her actions before trial. The court found that there was this question of neutrality, but stated that the court would still give the report the weight it deserves. However, never again in the order does the district court mention the weight with which it was weighing the custody evaluator's report, and the court truly, in fact, only took the recommendations of the custody evaluator that were ultimately helpful to respondent with respect to the big picture issues, with respect to the relocation, to the domestic abuse, but disregarded the pieces of that report that would have been beneficial or helpful to the appellant, namely the physical custody analysis and recommendation and the recommendations regarding parenting time with respect to that. So I think that's an important issue as well. With respect to, it was mentioned that, you know, this in appellant's medical records, that it was not raised, the domestic abuse was not raised as an issue. It wasn't noted in her medical records until 2014. I actually think that's quite noteworthy because the incident of alleged sexual abuse in this case took place earlier in 2014. So I think it's the timing there, I think, is actually quite noteworthy in terms of when she felt that that domestic abuse was an issue she needed to report to her own providers. With respect to the custody evaluator's investigation and discussions with the therapists, I don't think it's quite as cut and dry as respondent would like it to be. The custody evaluator at trial testified that she did not recall specifically asking the therapists about appellant's abuse allegations, but that she essentially that she must have because she always does in these types of cases. In fact, if you look at the therapy records themselves, these incidents were reported and were discussed specifically with appellant's individual therapist contemporaneously with when the events occurred. And I think that's important that, you know, regardless of the conversations that custody evaluator indicated that she had with these therapists, one, she didn't actually recall the conversations that she had with the therapists, and two, if the custody evaluator had requested the medical and mental health records, as is best practices in terms of custody evaluator's role, she would have seen that these allegations in these incidents were specifically discussed and were specifically alleged by appellant contemporaneously with the events. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That is the final oral argument on today's calendar, so the court is now in recess.